Today we're talking about linear algebra.
So to compute the intersection of two spaces, you write down this matrix, which you get by concatenating together the two bases. You compute the kernel of the matrix, which you do via computation of an echelon form. Once you have a matrix in echelon form, it's pretty much trivial to write down the kernel. You have one basis vector of the kernel corresponding to each non-pivot column of the echelon form. So an example echelon form is, say, so there's an example matrix in echelon form, and for each non-pivot column, that is each column for which you don't have a leading one, you have exactly one basis vector for the kernel. And I'll assume that you can put all this stuff already. So in this case, this matrix has rank 3. The kernel thus has dimension 1. And we should write down the basis for the kernel using this column. So let's see how you do that. So you just put a 1 at the non-pivot column and zeros everywhere else. Does that make sense? It seems ridiculous. Negative the entry of A at the non-pivot column in the row with that pivot element. So you put a 1. So I'm going to write down the element of the kernel. I'll put a 1 there, and I'll put zeros in all the other non-pivot columns. There aren't any other non-pivot columns. And then for each pivot column, I put the negative of the entry of A at the non-pivot column in the row with that pivot element. So that would be -0, -0, -1. And I've just written down one element of the.
These have to be coming from a column, from that column.
Right, you're right.
-1, -2, -1, -0.
Right, okay. That is right. So you take the non-pivot, you take a column with a non-pivot, which is not a pivot column, and then you can write down a vector in the kernel, and these give you a basis for the kernel. Completely standard. Any questions? Okay. And to compute the intersection, what you do is you write down the kernel, and each element of the kernel is, well, it's each element of the kernel of this augmented matrix is a vector v, so that when you take that vector and multiply it by this matrix, you get 0, of course. But what that gives you, whenever you have a vector times this matrix giving you 0, what you have is explicitly a linear combination of the columns of A1 plus a linear combination of the columns of A2 equal to 0. And the coefficients in the linear combination of the columns of, say, A2, I mean, they can't all be 0, otherwise you would have that the columns of A1 are dependent. So any time you have an element of the kernel of this augmented matrix, you just forget about, take the vector in the kernel, like this, just forget about the last few entries that correspond to the columns of A2, take the corresponding linear combination of the columns of A1, and you get an element that, it's a linear combination of the columns of A1 that's equal to the negative of a linear combination of the columns of A2. In other words, it's something in the kernel. Something in the intersection. Let me just write that. The intersection of E and W is the set of, how to write this, if you write the kernel vectors as, say, V1, V2, it's a set of A1, V1, such that V1, V2 is in the basis for the kernel of A. Okay, so that's just an illustration of how a linear algebra operation that is intersecting two spaces can be encoded as computing the echelon form or kernel of a matrix. Okay, and you can encode everything that way. Any comments? So other things you can do are adding together two subspaces. Of course, you have to say what you mean by representing the answer. A typical way to represent a subspace is to give a basis in reduced row echelon form. So here what you would do is, each time you take one of the basis vectors for the kernel, you take the top part of that vector, read off the corresponding linear combination of the basis of V, then you put those all together. Unfortunately, the resulting thing you get will be really bad. It won't be in reduced row echelon form. So you have to put that in echelon form. But think carefully after you try to do this reasonably efficiently.
Could these generate beams like that?
What?
These can be generators.
Yeah, let me think, are they a basis or not? I doubt they're a basis. Yeah, I don't think they're... I'll have to think about that for a second. They might be a basis, actually. I think they're a basis. Because it probably depends on whether or not... I think there are bases, but can everybody just think about it for a second and see if it comes out first? So the question is, if you write down a kernel for the augmented matrix A1A2, and then use this procedure to write down a whole bunch of elements that are clearly in the kernel, clearly in the intersection of an intersection of E and W, does the resulting list of vectors that are clearly in the intersection of E and W, does that form a basis for the intersection? Certainly spans it. And I think it's a basis, but I just want to think about it for a minute. See if anybody else can agree. So it spans it. You just need to count dimensions. Seems like you should just get it from a dimension count.
Yeah.
So I think it is a basis. The problem is it's not a nice basis. Mm-hmm. It's not an echelon form basis. It's just a whole bunch of random ish looking linear combinations of the columns of your original matrix they want. And if you want to do this in practice, you might as well choose of these two, take the space of smaller dimension, and then you end up having to take linear combinations of less vectors. Okay. This is just an illustration of how to convert the sort of actual operations you want to do in linear algebra, such as you have two spaces, you want to intersect them, maybe you want to take some. There are a number of things. Very standard operation is if you have one space and a subspace, you want to compute with the quotient. That's another standard operation that you have to be able to do if you want to really work with linear algebra. If you really want to work with vector spaces. Okay, so that's just an illustration of how this sort of thing might be relevant. Alright, so the standard way to find the echelon form is Gaussian elimination, which everybody knows. And you might know that it's a lot of work. And the really annoying thing that happens, if you take a matrix and compute its reduced row echelon form, typically the entries get really, really big in the resulting answer. It depends a lot on the type of matrix you're considering. But if you want to do something really devious, just take, write down a completely random 3x3 matrix. Then if you ask them to compute the reduced row echelon form, it's a random matrix, odds are the reduced row echelon form of a 3x3 matrix will just be the identity matrix, because, if you have a matrix and it's invertible, its reduced row echelon form is just the identity matrix. On the other hand, you're going to encounter a lot of big numbers in the process of computing the reduced row echelon form. It'll be kind of annoying. If you do this, you'll have to clear the first column, and that will make these numbers bigger. And then when you clear the second column, you'll probably end up having to divide by something, so you get all these big fractions. And then suddenly, at the very end, you just get back the identity matrix.
So. Yes, this is invertible. It's got non-determinant.
Excellent. Thank you. Don't know quite how you did that, but thank you.
Just produced in my tears.
Ah. Oh, good. Thanks. Okay. That's a good trick to know about if you want to compute the echelon form of a square matrix. Reduce it mod a prime and just check to see if modulo any prime at all, it has echelon form the identity. So that's echelon form. Now I'm going to tell you about what's called a multi-modular algorithm to compute echelon forms. Okay? So this would involve two ideas. Before I dive into this, just a few remarks that aren't in the notes right now. In matrix algebra, the fundamental operation that people try to express other problems in terms of, and they try to optimize, is matrix multiplication. And I don't know what the latest theorem is, but people often ask the question, how many arithmetic operations does it take to multiply two n by n matrices asymptotically? So the answer is big O of 2 plus something, and the blank always keeps getting smaller, but it's a lot less than 1 here. So it's the naive matrix multiplication algorithm takes big O of n cubed arithmetic operations in your base ring, or your base field. But using a clever trick, I think it was introduced by Strassen, you can reduce it to O of 2 plus something. I'll just write epsilon, where epsilon is hopefully convergent to 0 as a function of time, but maybe it's around 0.3 or 0.2. I don't know what the latest is, but it's a lot less than 1. So there's this asymptotically fast way to multiply matrices. And hence, if you can reduce a question to matrix multiplication, for example, echelon forms or kernels or any of these questions that reduce to echelon forms, then when your matrices get really, really big, and by the way, this method isn't so good when n is small, but when n is big, or big is around 100 or so, certainly around 1,000 or so, then these asymptotically fast matrix multiply methods can be incredibly efficient in comparison to what you get with an O of n cubed algorithm. If you think about it, n cubed is a lot bigger than n to the 2.3 when n is 1,000, for example. So a huge, huge difference. Quickly, the way the Strassen algorithm works is, so this is, there's generalizations of this that give a better runtime than what Strassen gets, but if you have two matrices, and unfortunately I can't remember the exact details, so I haven't decided to tell you this until just now, but if you have two 2x2 matrices, there's a formula for the product of these two matrices that involves less multiplications than you might expect. So if you use the naive algorithm, how many multiplies do you have to use?
Eight.
Eight multiplies. Well, Strassen wrote down a funny formula that gives you the product of these two matrices using only 7 multiplies.
So,
and then a really nice little observation is that his formula makes sense even if the entries that you're multiplying don't commute. So instead of viewing these as individual numbers, view them as matrices. So if you have two, say, 2048 by 2048 matrices, you can break them up into, break each one up into 4 1024 by 1024 matrices, and then multiply those. But you use his formula to reduce what a priori, using a naive method, would be 8 matrix multiplies and some additions to 7 matrix multiplies and some additions. And now for each of those 1024 by 1024 matrix multiplies, you break it up into 4 smaller ones, and it's reduced to 7 512 by 512 matrix multiplies. Of course, you have to do it twice. I guess it's 14 of them. So you have 7. And then for each of these 7, you have to do 7 more. But it turns out to be way, 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 way better. And what you do is you do this recursive decomposition using 7 multiplies each time instead of 8 until you get down to a small matrix, maybe 50 by 50 or 100 by 100, and then you just multiply using some standard algorithm. And then sort of everything unwinds and you end up getting your matrix multiply. You ended up doing somehow O of n to the 2 point something arithmetic operations instead of big O of n cubed. So it's very, very cool. The process of computing the reduced row echelon form can also be reduced to matrix multiplication. That's kind of not so obvious. I mean, if you think about what is computing reduced rational form have to do with matrix multiplication? How could you possibly relate the two? And I'll just say something quickly. And here. So just since I really morally need to tell you this, there's a connection between echelon forms and matrix multiplication. Which I've never implemented. So if somebody wants to do this as a project, maybe Sage people want their project implement echelon form via matrix multiplication. I would be very interested in that. But I've never got around to doing it. And as far as I know, there's only one program that does implement this, which is Magma.
Is that by other information?
No. I'll show you in a second. It's kind of fun. And it's not just matrix multiplication, but the runtime is dominated by some matrix multiplications. So first claim, this is a little bit loose because I'm doing this from memory from a talk I saw, but I understand it pretty well. The first claim is that you can reduce echelon form computation to computing the inverse of a matrix, and then doing a matrix multiply. Modulus some easier stuff. Which I don't know the exact details about implementing and what subtleties come up, but I think I can work them out. But claim one echelon forms can be computed. If you can compute, well, it's not so much that it can be, it's just. I'll just say one is reducing to computing an inverse. And by reducing, I don't mean you're doing a trivial amount of work, but you're doing work that doesn't dominate. So I'll show you how to do that. And then once you have this, the question remains, how do you compute the inverse of a matrix using matrix multiplication? But then you just kind of go back to your idea over here of Strassen, which is, look at a matrix as a block, sort of a 2x2 block of other matrices. There's a formula for the inverse of a 2x2 matrix, which you kind of, I don't know, when you take, certainly if you teach linear algebra, you find yourself memorizing that formula for the quarter. Let's say this is just a 2x2 matrix. The inverse is 1 over AD minus BC, I think it's DA minus C minus B, is that right? And then you always check that AD, yeah. 1, 0, 0. So this is a formula for the inverse of a matrix. It works even if these entries are matrices, as long as AD minus BC is invertible as a matrix. So, and you also have to reformulate it a little bit. It's better to write it as, let's see, how do you do that? Well, you just let's just call this E. So then you rewrite this as E inverse D minus E inverse B. E minus E inverse C, E inverse A. And now, there's a problem with this did I do something wrong?
Okay.
This might be a slight lie, but there's a way to do this.
You should be A minus CD.
Oh, right, to make it non-commutative. To make it work for non-commutative ones. Okay, what is it again?
And you need A and C commute, right?
No. There's no assumption that any of these commute. You have to write down a formula for the inverse of a 2x2 matrix over a non-commutative ring. And you can do that. I know you can do that. I've seen it. Check it. And I think James just told me. Okay, so if you multiply this by, I'm not sure how to work this out right now, but if you take, let's see, if you multiply this matrix by that matrix, or some trace of E, you get A, E inverse. Maybe this should go on the other side. I don't know, let's see. You can do whatever you want since you're coming up with a new algorithm. So maybe the order should be the other way. So D, E inverse. Probably shouldn't be trying to give the details, but if you multiply here, you get A, D, E inverse minus B, C, E inverse as the upper left entry of the product. If you multiply this matrix times the one down there, and now you can factor out E inverse, and it's the inverse of AD minus B. I mean, E is AD minus BC. So this upper left entry is the identity matrix. And then for the next one, it's minus AB E inverse plus BA E inverse. Ooh, that's a problem.
Yeah,
it's possible to do this. I can't remember the formula. So,
yeah.
But it is possible to do this.
Nice stuff. We're just going to get opposite order in two corners, and that's not going
to
work.
But there is a way to make this work. I'm absolutely certain of that. And I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. There's an explicit formula for the inverse. I think it involves inverting individual entries as well. So just trust me, there's a formula for this. You don't trust me. But there is a formula for the inverse in a non-commutative setting, which I do not remember off the top of my head.
And then, like, 2 pages is missing.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, it goes right from page 1 to page 1.
That's annoying. The lost pages. Huh. Must have ran down the stairs too quickly and they went flying out of my head. Or they got caught in the photocopy machine. Which, just to finish quickly, and I'll say more about this next time, there is a formula for this inverse, which I doubt we can trivially rewrite. I mean, maybe it's just not so obvious. There's a formula for the inverse that involves inverting matrices that are related to what comes here. And you can do those inversions if so what you do is, if you want to invert a big matrix, what you do is you break it up into four smaller matrices, and then you do some matrix multiplies that appear in here, and some inversions that appear in here. The inversions that appear in here, you do those by, again, breaking up the matrices right here. If you need A inverse, you break that up. So by successively breaking up, you reduce the problem of computing the inverse of a square matrix. It has to be a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. So you reduce computing the inverse of that matrix to computing the inverses of other matrices in matrix multiplication. And the inverses of the other matrices, they're smaller matrices, half as big, so you can compute their inverses also using matrix multiplication. Okay? So computing inverses can be done using matrix multiplication, much to the fact that I haven't given you the formula, which there is such a formula, which is what it is. So now the other question is, how do you reduce to computing an inverse? And that's the following. So so here's what you do. You have to figure out what the pivot columns are. Once you figure out what the pivot columns are, you compute the inverse of the submatrix got from those pivot columns, and then you multiply that inverse matrix by the original matrix, and the result will be the reduced row echelon form. Because what you'll get is the identity matrix exactly where the pivot columns are, and then whatever else you have doesn't matter, and hence you've got the reduced row echelon form. Now, the way you find the pivot columns is by taking your matrix and reducing it modulo some big prime, and doing echelon form modulo that big prime via some method modulo prime. And that could just be, you know, straight Gaussian elimination. But usually that's incredibly simple compared to the difficulty of computing the echelon form over here. Of course, there's a question, did you choose the right prime? And there are ways you can discover whether or not you chose, whether or not the answer was right at the end. And I'm not sure what to do. So for most prime numbers, P, especially large ones, well, for all the finitely many prime members P, any prime that doesn't divide any denominator of your matrix or the determinant, the pivot columns of the matrix modulo that prime will be the same as the pivot columns of the original matrix. So in order to reduce to computing an inverse, you compute a submatrix from the pivot columns. So say these are the pivot columns. So when you find the pivot columns by working on P, and two, you extract the submatrix from them. Then you take this matrix that you extract from the pivot columns, and you compute its inverse. And then you just multiply on the left your original matrix by the inverse of the matrix coming from the pivot columns and corresponding rows, and the result will be the reduced Rochelle form. And you compute the inverse of this matrix that you extract from the pivot columns using this asymptotically fast matrix inversion algorithm, which reduces matrix inversion to matrix multiplication. So I apologize for lack of details, but as far as I know, this algorithm isn't written down anywhere. I only heard about it in a talk that Alan Steele gave and a seminar I ran. And maybe it's almost like a trade secret of Magma, how this works or something. So I mean, it's open right there. But Magma, one of the things that got me using Magma originally was that its echelon form algorithm over the rational numbers is vastly faster than anything I'd ever seen before in any other program. It just blew me away how incredibly fast it was. And that's one of the crucial things you need to compute modular symbols, is fast echelon forms over the rationals. So I really got into it for that reason, and I eventually asked Alan how it works, and this is what it does. The way he computes echelon forms of matrices over Q is via this matrix multiplication method. He finds a submatrix got by working modulo prime, so that if you can compute the inverse of that submatrix, then you do a matrix multiply, and you get the reduced rational form. And matrix multiplies are asymptotically faster than when you multiply two matrices together, you get to take advantage of this recursive decomposition idea, and you really make a huge gain, especially when the matrix is big. You get a huge gain. Okay. One thing that is puzzling me is that I don't see any way to use matrix multiplication to compute echelon forms of matrices over finite fields. So, I mean, because at some point you have to start by finding a submatrix that's invertible that you can multiply through to get something to reduce Rochelle form. Maybe you can just guess any submatrix. Invert if it's not invertible, you throw it away. If it is invertible, compute its inverse, multiply. You can always tell whether a matrix is in reduced Rochelle form. So via an appropriately clever sequence of guessing, you can probably use this algorithm also over a finite field to compute echelon forms. Okay, so that's how to reduce, in broad strokes, how to reduce computation of echelon forms to matrix multiplication. The quick summary is you reduce it to computing the inverse of a matrix and multiplying your matrix by the inverse of some other matrix to get something in reduced echelon form. And second, you reduce computing an inverse to a whole bunch of matrix multiplications via some formula. And third, it's important to note that matrix multiplication can be done more quickly using some clever formulas than you might otherwise expect. I mean, I think that this inversion formula is just somewhat clever, and like Strassen's formula is pretty clever. It took a while to come up with. And there's also a 3x3 Strassen, by the way. You decompose your matrix into three something, into a 9x9 matrix of matrices, and then there's a quick, which is better than the Strassen 2x2 one, there's a quick way of writing down the product of two 3x3 matrices. And there's actually a whole research program which is about finding optimal ways of writing down products of two matrices where you maybe use bigger and bigger matrices. And it's, I think, an open problem to know what the best possible matrix multiplication algorithm is. Okay, so that's really completely telling you all about that. And now the other thing I want to tell you about is how to use a multi-modular method for computing echelon forms. And this algorithm is incredibly good for sparse matrices over the rationals. It's extremely good memory-wise, and it just has all the right properties to work well. And I'll describe it for you now. So, and you can also use it for dense matrices. So here's the idea in broad, in two or three sentences. So here's the sketch of the idea. You have a matrix over the rational numbers, and you want to compute its reduced row echelon form. Here's what you do. You take your matrix, and you first clear all the denominators. So it's just a matrix of integers. Now you take your favorite prime, such as 389, or to quote Leinster, you take your favorite prime, which is 389, and we had Leinster quotes on a web page, but that was one of them, except his wasn't 389, his was 37. But you take your favorite prime, take the matrix and reduce it modulo that prime, and then using any echelon form algorithm you like, perhaps just Gauss elimination or something more intelligent, working over the finite field FP, you compute the reduced row echelon form of your matrix, just modulo that one prime. And then you save that result, and you do the same thing modulo another prime, and you do the same thing modulo yet another prime. Maybe you do it modulo, 20 different primes. Then you take all those reduced row echelon forms together and use the Chinese remainder theorem to get what is likely to be, but not for sure, the reduced row echelon form of your original matrix reduced modulo the product of all those primes. Except, there's a little subtlety, because think about it, the answer that you get if you do this Chinese remainder theorem thing, it's a matrix and all of its entries are integers. Whereas if you think about any reduced row echelon form, like on page 98 of the notes, there's a reduced row echelon form. There are huge rational, huge denominators. You get these big chunky rational numbers. So it's kind of annoying. So there's something called rational reconstruction, which is described in complete detail in Knuth's book on computer science, The Art of Computing. And unfortunately, so this is on page 99. So it's an algorithm that does the following. It's pretty neat. Page 99 you should have.
Yeah.
The proof. Really? Oh, dang it. And so I can blame it on the copy machine. He has the original copy. Yeah, so I can blame it on the copy machine. I didn't catch one of the pages. Okay, so that's really weird, actually. It must have got the page, but just not the back side of it. So two pages must have stuck together. Okay, so here's what rational reconstruction does for you. But by the way, this isn't the only problem with the algorithm I just described. There's one other subtle problem that that occurs. So rational reconstruction is the following thing. If you have, say you have a rational number n over d, numerator over denominator, and you reduce it modulo m, and you get a number a. So here m is just some big number. So you have this number a. Can you think of an algorithm, if you were just given a and m, that would allow you to recover n over d? Well, in general, no, of course not, because n and d could be huge, and maybe m is 2 or something, so there's no chance that you can uniquely recover n over d. However, if you make a bound on n and d, so let me make sure it is exactly the bound. Here, it's going to be off by 1 or something, but if you require the absolute value of n and d to be less than or equal to the square root of m over 2, then there's a unique. This n over d, if there is a rational number that reduces to a mod m, it's unique. So there can't be two different rational numbers that reduce to the same thing, so long as you make the numerator and denominator of your rational number this small. And I think that's pretty elementary to see. Let me think about it for a second. Basically, I guess if you have two numbers that reduce to the same thing, the difference reduced to zero, but since the numbers are so, the numerators and denominators are so small, you can just explicitly compute their difference and see that it doesn't reduce to zero. That's just some argument like that. But if you require these to be small, then the number d is uniquely determined, if it exists. So, so what you're imagining is that you have the reduced row echelon form of your matrix over Q out there, and you want to know what it is. And what you've done is you've computed it modulo a whole bunch of primes. And if you take, for all the finitely many primes, if you take a matrix and reduce that matrix mod P and then compute the reduced row echelon form, you get exactly the same thing as if you computed the reduced row echelon form and then reduced that modulo P. That will only fail for a couple of primes. So you take all those, you take them together, use the Chinese remainder theorem, and then you use this fact that there's a unique thing that lifts, if it lifts at all, and then, well, you can lift. Now, there's a really naive way to find n over d given a. You can just take your a and start multiplying it by various things until you finally find an integer n that's at most square root of m over 2 from 0. So you could just compute a, and if it satisfies this constraint, then you run. You can try 2 times a, you can try 3 times a, and so on, until finally getting something that that is equivalent modulo m to an n that's less than root m over 2. But of course, that would be hideously slow. There's a much better way to go, which is what's described in section 7.2, algorithm 7.2.1, called rational reconstruction. There's an algorithm that's listed here. It's almost identical to the extended Euclidean algorithm. It's basically like doing the Euclidean algorithm to compute a GCD with, I don't have much time, so let me just say it's very similar to doing the Euclidean algorithm. And watching what happens, and at each step, you get something that that approximately gives you an n over d, and either somewhere through this algorithm you find n over d, or you prove that there's no n over d, that it doesn't exist. So let me just give you an idea of why this works. There's a lot to explain here. So first, the reference is Newt, volume 2, page 656. Everything is explained in detail there. But you have an algorithm, and at each step of the algorithm, you compute. Basically, at each step, you get the information of an equation of this form. So every single time in the algorithm, you're computing an n and a d, so that n over d is congruent to a modulo. You're getting, at each step of the algorithm, you get an equation like this for various values of b0, and this is exactly the congruence you're trying to solve. If you can find an n and a d so that n is congruent mod m to ad, then n over d is congruent to a mod m, and you've lifted. And what you need is that the n and d are small. So I barely told you anything, but that's where I'll stop telling you about this.
So there's something called rational reconstruction. It comes from the Euclidean algorithm, and it allows you to find a rational number that lifts an integer modulo m.
So what I want you to take away from this is that if you ever come into a situation like that in your work where you have a number that you've computed a reduction of modulo something, you can lift it, and you can lift it uniquely. And there's an algorithm for doing this described in this book. You can read more about it in my notes.
Okay? So I'm not going to give you all the details of a proof, but I encourage you to look at the details. Okay, finally,
so basically modulo subtleties, I told you how to compute echelon forms via a multi-modular method. But there are a couple of subtleties.
So one subtlety is, what do you do if you accidentally choose the wrong p? What if you choose a prime number p and it does divide, say, the determinant of your matrix if your matrix is square? Or it's just not the case that the reduction, that the reduced rational form of the reduction of your matrix modulo p is the reduction mod p of the echelon form you're trying to compute. So how can you detect that? That's something that you can answer. That's answered in my notes on the page that I didn't, that got stuck together. So that's one problem that you have to worry about, and which I know exactly what the answer to is. The answer is the following. So here's your original matrix, and you don't know what the pivot columns are, but there's some pivot columns. If you compute the reduction of that matrix and then compute its reduced rational form, so A, A1, P, and then I'll just call this the echelon form of A, echelon of A mod P. This also has pivot columns. So there are certain columns that have a leading one. And the pivot columns of the of this echelon form are the same as the pivot columns of this one, if and only if this is the right echelon form. So that's something that you can check carefully. Now the problem is you still don't know what the pivot columns are of your matrix here. So what I just told you isn't enough. However, here's what you do. You reduce your matrix mod p, compute the echelon form, know what the pivot columns are, then you work modulo another prime and know what the pivot columns are. And any time you see, if ever you see a matrix and its pivot columns aren't, have, you know, there are less pivot columns or they're not as leftmost as the pivot columns that you've seen so far, you just throw that one away. So you take only the matrices mod p, for which when you compute their reduction modulo p and compute their echelon form, the set of pivot columns is maximal. That is, you have the maximal number of columns and they're as far left as possible. And if you do that, of course, eventually, since eventually it will be the case that the pivot columns of the reduction of the echelon form of the reduction are the same as the pivot columns of this, you will have thrown away all the ones at the beginning when the pivot columns weren't correct. Of course, you could be worried that maybe you'd get the wrong pivot columns for all 50 primes that you try, just because your matrix might happen to have bad behavior with all those. But you can deal with this, because let's say you got all the same pivot columns, and, well, I guess I have to explain the second part of the algorithm but before I can tell you why. But you can deal with every single problem that comes up. So that was one problem. You have to always choose the pivot columns to be maximal. So another issue is, how do you know that you have the right answer at the end? Okay, let's suppose you work modulo a whole bunch of primes, and then you reassemble using the Chinese remainder theorem, then you use rational reconstruction, and at each point when you compute the lift of an entry, it turns out that there is a unique n over d that reduces mod the product of your primes to the number that you found using echelon forms in the Chinese remainder theorem. Suppose there is such a number, that is, that the rational reconstruction algorithm doesn't stop at some point and tell you that there's no rational Bolichian number, then you get this matrix, and this matrix is in a reduced row echelon form, and you'd like to know, is it the reduced row echelon form of your original matrix? You know, how do you know, can you compute a bound in the number of primes you have to use? And probably you can compute a bound in the number of primes, but there's a much more clever way to go about it, which, well, basically what you do is you look at how big the numbers are in the purported echelon form, and you look at how big the numbers are in your original matrix, and we just do a little linear algebra, and assuming a certain bound is satisfied involving the sizes of the numbers in the relevant matrices, then you get a proof, just by writing down some details, you get a proof that your matrix was the correct echelon form. So you just have to look at the size of the numbers. Basically, if you did something wrong along the way so that you would not have the correct echelon form when you use the Chinese remainder theorem and rational reconstruction, then the numbers that appeared in this matrix would be too big. And so you can detect whether you have the right thing. So even if you were to choose primes p very unluckily so that you got the wrong pivot columns every time, but always the same ones, you would detect that at the end, because your proof that the echelon form is correct wouldn't happen. The height bounds just wouldn't work out right, and you'd have to try more primes. And eventually you would try enough primes that you would see the correct pivot columns, and then that would cause you to throw away all the bad primes that you had used before and all the bad pivot columns you had used before, and then ever after you get the correct pivot columns, and then putting all those together you would get the correct echelon form. So this algorithm works extremely well when your matrix is sparse because, and so the situation with modular symbols, when you want to compute a presentation for a modular symbol space, here's the situation you're in. Okay, 30 seconds. So you have a big sparse matrix with rational entries. Most of them are ones and zeros. And it's incredibly sparse. And you want to compute its echelon form. And it just turns out that in practice, the echelon form has very, very small entries in it. So it makes sense to work modulo, say, a couple of primes, and then hopefully from that recover the echelon form that you want, that you should get. So what you do is you just do this algorithm. You do just the standard Gauss elimination modulo each of those primes, though you want to be a little bit intelligent in choosing which row you use to clear a column. So if your matrix is sparse, you maybe choose the row with the least number of non-zero entries in it, so that when you clear the column, you minimize fill-in. But you do this modulo just like three or four primes, you lift, and you get a matrix, and then you can use these height bounds that I mentioned before to prove that you actually got the right answer. And it takes advantage of the fact that you expect for other reasons that the echelon form will have small entries in it. So that was harder to explain than I thought. So I hope I wasn't incredibly confusing, but it's really pretty elementary stuff. It's just there's a lot of it. So there are a lot of different ways to go at this. And these methods are all really a lot different than what you get in numerical analysis, where you work with floating point numbers. You don't have the option of reducing modulo prime. And you know, numerical analysts look at Strassen and they think that isn't practical, strangely enough. And for what they do, it isn't. But for what, when you work with a